The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, everyone. This morning I read a news article about a study. It was an article in the BBC online news website. And it was an article about a large study done in England from 38,000 people. And the conclusion of the study is that the leading predictor for stress, depression, and anxiety is rumination. And rumination is a great word in English, boy. If you look it up in the dictionary, it has two meanings. It means to keep thinking about something repeatedly, and it means the second meaning is a cow that chews its cud. And that it really means to chew. The word comes from the Latin word to chew or chew again. And it's quite nice with a cow, you know, I don't know if you know this, but cows will eat grass and they'll swallow it, and then in their leisure when they have time off, they'll sit there peacefully and they regurgitate that grass into their mouths so they could chew it. And they chew it more thoroughly, and then they swallow it again. So I suppose we have like this, you know, extra pocket someplace in our brain, you know, belly in our brain. We take these life events, and we take them in, and then we store them back there. And when we have a chance, we regurgitate them. And then we chew them, and chew them, and chew them again and again. And many years ago, I did the famous raisin exercise. It's one, probably the most famous mindfulness exercise in America, where apparently Jon Kabat-Zinn, I think it maybe came up with it, was on a television program to introduce mindfulness, and he was going to introduce it to the television host. And so the exercise involves taking a raisin and slowly chewing it mindfully, holding it and looking at it a little bit quietly. And it takes quite a while before you put it in your mouth, and then you chew it slowly. And when the television, the guy and the host realized what was going on, he immediately curtailed it, because you can't on television have the audience sit there watch while someone is slowly eating their raisin in silence. So anyway, it's just taking a raisin, chewing it. So I chewed and chewed the raisin. And if you chew it long enough, the sweetness and the flavor goes out. And there's no sweetness. It tastes like cardboard. So we take in our life experiences. We store them in our second stomach. And then we regurgitate them, and we chew them and chew them and chew them. And after a while, if there was any sweetness there to begin with, it goes away, but it starts becoming, after a while, these things can be deadly, produce a tremendous amount of stress. And what the article said is that that they're thinking, and now that the most important issue around anxiety and depression and things like that is not the life events people have, but rather how they ruminate about it. Rumination and self-blame were talked about together. But they said rumination is actually has a more important role than self-blame. And so the analogy I like to do for this is that I could be fixated on the striker. I can hold the striker. I can hold on to the striker. I can think that it's really important for me to have a good striker when I'm a Dharma teacher, to strike the bell. And so I'm not going to let go of the striker. And so because I'm so attached to it, I grip it really, really tight. And in gripping it really tight, after a while, my hand hurts, and it goes numb, then it freezes up, and then the ligaments kind of glue together and whatever. And so it's really becomes a problem for my life, how I hold it. And I continually blaming the striker. The striker is the problem, or the people who want to take my striker away is the problem. But the stress that my hand is under is not the striker or the people who want to have it, but has to do with how I'm gripping it and how I never let go of it. So in the same way with our thinking mind, the life events, how we hold, how we relate, how we engage in telling the story and repeating the memories, it's how we relate to it, what our mind does in its psychology that might be more important sometimes than the event itself. People can go through major life difficulties, major crises, things that shouldn't happen, and that's unfortunate for sure. And there can be all kinds of lasting effects. But one of the things that has a huge impact on how well people do or how difficult these things are for people has to do with, do they ruminate? Do they tell the story over and over again? Do they blame themselves? There's a self-blame as part of it. And it could be that the ruminations, the thinking about it, might seem true, the thinking might be true, but that doesn't require us to keep thinking about it. For a Dharma teacher to have a bell striker is a good thing. You know, you ring the bell at the end of the sitting, and you know, it's a nice thing. But does a Dharma teacher always need to hold it? You know, you can pick it up when it's needed. So this rumination, figuring out our life, trying to solve things over and over and over again through our thoughts. And it's, you know, kind of astounding. If you kept a log of how many times you had the same general thoughts, it's kind of an amazing number. And the amount of reruns the mind goes through. You know, the season's over and they're just doing the reruns. But I don't think we tend to look, we don't keep a log, and so we don't tend to kind of notice how often we're having the same theme going through, same consideration over and over again. Partly because we're trying to deal with something, trying to resolve something, fix something. And sometimes the rumination, the repetitive thinking we have, is the problem itself. It's what adds to the stress, adds to the difficulty. But because the rumination is about something, we are blinded by the something we're thinking about to not notice how we're thinking. So if I'm fixated on the striker, and so that's all I'm concerned with, I don't notice the cost of gripping it. But at some point, if someone points their attention, my attention to my grip, say, oh yeah, I guess I am holding it harder than I need to, so I can let go. So how do we hold on to our thoughts? What are the role of thoughts in our lives? Is a really useful thing to investigate. And begin taking responsibility for our thinking mind rather than letting our thinking mind do whatever it pleases. Let it have free rein of the playground, but to say, you know, you can't, you know, to begin directing the mind a certain way, think in wiser ways, let go of certain thoughts. To learn to be wise about the thinking mind is a really crucial part of any kind of, I think, spiritual practice, any kind of, certainly Buddhist practice. And in Buddhism, we have two primary, very broad kind of practices to support and help us with overcoming the rumination of the mind, to interrupt the repetitive quality of that. And one is mindfulness, and the other is concentration. Mindfulness helps us see more clearly what's going on, and in seeing more clearly, it gives us the option, option to choose different ways of relating to the thinking. Concentration then is one of those alternative ways that concentration sometimes can cut through the thinking mind, weaken the force that keeps us connected to it. If we get concentrated on the breath, for example, and don't give much attention to the thoughts or keep pulling back from the thoughts or letting go of them, slowly the energy for thinking begins to lessen. And they don't have such a grip on us. It's quite a powerful thing for the mind to let go of what it's thinking. And even if you can only let go for a moment, and then you're back into whatever you're thinking about, that movement of letting go is a very, very meaningful thing for the mind in terms of training the mind, freeing the mind, loosening the mind. And if you keep doing it, you have to do it over and over again. Slowly, that muscle of letting go, that muscle of beginning to choose where your mind goes, becomes stronger and stronger. So, In this study that I read, they talked about, they refer to the kind of rumination that is stressful, causes anxiety and depression, as negative thinking. And this, I think this is a kind of common enough in English to talk about, you know, negative emotions, negative thinking, to just refer to it that way. It's a little bit abstract, perhaps, to consider what is negative, what's a negative thought. In the Buddhist tradition, the differentiation is between those thoughts which are skillful and those which are unskillful. Or to put it in maybe more common language, those which are thoughts which are useful and the thoughts which are not only not useful, but maybe even damaging to have. And to be able to distinguish between those is very important. So to be able to see the consequences of what we're thinking about and how we're, not only what we're thinking about, but how we're thinking. You can think about things which have, in a sense, positive thoughts, but how we think about it is damaging. So something, for example, as a positive thing might be thoughts about generosity, but someone can be neurotically fixated in wanting to be a generous person, and so they're constantly kind of thinking about how to be generous and what should I do and how should I do it, and the mind is so claustrophobic around those thoughts that the how we are sometimes needs to be addressed, not what we're thinking about. So both of these things. So skillful and unskillful. So in the suttas, there is a discourse called Removing Distracting Thoughts in the middle-length discourses. And here is an interesting list of progressive strategies the text recommends for overcoming these unskillful ways of thinking. So it begins, without necessarily saying so, the text, by assuming that you can recognize when your thoughts are unskillful. So it requires some modicum of self-awareness to notice, you know, I've been thinking the same thing over and over again. What I'm thinking about now is draining me. It's stressing me out. It's causing anxiety. It's causing me to be depressed. And it's possible to see that. It's been said, I read about a study once about, they studied, I don't know if it was women or teenage girls, and how they felt after they read fashion magazines. The results of the study was that as a generalization, as a whole, as a statistic, women feel worse about themselves after reading these fashion magazines than they were before. So I don't know if it resonates with some of you, the women here, or some of the men who are living with women. But I suppose there's men magazines that do the same thing for men. So to recognize the toll it has on us, our energy drains, our feelings drains, we were kind of feeling good before and now we feel bad, heavier. Now there's thoughts of self-blame or self-criticism, I'm not good enough, that come on. And to recognize that these are not helpful for us. And not be swayed or convinced by the voice that says, well, it's accurate. It's true. And even if it's true that you're a lousy person, boy, are you ever. You're like a really lousy person. Let's just say, for the moment, let's just say it's true. Who says that you need to keep thinking that? Who has told you that you have to keep repeating those thoughts and reminding yourself all the time that, you know, yes, I almost forgot, I'm lousy. And then, you know, tell your friends, you know, I tend to forget this, so if I forget, can you remind me? You know, there's no need to keep having those thoughts over and over again, and the consequence is detrimental for our mental health. The article said that, I guess the UN or someone has done a study, UNESCO, I don't know who, that claim that a quarter of people in the world have some kind of mental challenge, psychological challenge. I guess it's a wide range of what those challenges can be. That's a big number. And it was in the context of this article that rumination has a really a big key role for this, you know, for the statistic. So the Buddha then gives in this the discourse strategies of how to deal with when you recognize you have unskillful thoughts, what to do. So the first thing that's recommended is substitute those unskillful thoughts with skillful thoughts, with useful things to think about. So it could be that you reframe a situation from what is an interpretation, a perspective which is draining, to one that's encouraging, that's more meaningful and uplifting. It doesn't mean kind of being Pollyannish about it, meaning kind of putting, you know, pretending it's better than it is. But, you know, one simple reframe of a challenge would be, there's a challenge they have to do, and the unskillful thought would be, this is really a drag, and this is going to be hard for me, and I'm not up for the task, but I have to do it anyway. Isn't this too bad? Another way is, I have to do it, and let me try to do that in such a way that I can be mindful while I do it, since we're a mindfulness tradition. Or let me do it and see if in the doing of it, I can become a better person in doing it. Let's see, how can I do this thing that I have to do in such a way that it makes someone else feel better while I do it, even if I'm going to feel bad. Those are not, you know, it's not necessarily creating some false impression on it. It's just kind of approaching it for a different purpose that maybe makes you feel better about what you're about to do. So reframing the situation, offering a different perspective on it, sometimes can break the trance of the negative thinking, the unskillful thinking. Sometimes what's helpful is to think about something entirely different. If you go to Best Buy, an electronics store, and boy, do they have a lot of things. I went yesterday with a friend who had never been to Best Buy, and I said, are you sure you got enough sleep last night? Did you eat well? Because this is going to be stressful to go in there. And so I go in there and, you know, this is really depressing. I mean, I would like to have that big television, but it's bigger than my living room. You know, I think the problem is I need a bigger house. And on it goes, you know. And so the mind can go off down these tracks. So I think I better think something different. Maybe I should not go to Best Buy, or, you know. And so sometimes changing what we think about, totally, not reframing it, but thinking about something which is uplifting or meaningful or more useful. I like the word useful. If what you're thinking is not useful, why don't you think about something more useful? So I do this regularly in my life. I think I tend to do it more often when I'm driving. And sometimes when I walk down here Sunday morning, I will start thinking about something, and I recognize this is fine what I'm thinking about, but it's not really so useful to go down these lines. And I think what I can do instead is I can think about the talk I'm going to give. I'm coming down here anyway, so let's, you know, and that's what I'm going to do. And so let me direct my mind into something that's more useful. And I don't feel like I'm covering over anything when I do that. It's just that I'm using my time better. Now then the discourse goes on and says, if that doesn't work, which it might not, then consider directly the kind of thinking you're having. And consider, the text calls it, the danger or the disadvantage of these kinds of thinking. So this here is really understanding the consequences, that having these kinds of thoughts is damaging to me, it's maybe going to be damaging to others. This is not healthy to have these kinds of thoughts. They're not beautiful. The text gives an example. They're not beautiful. It gives an example of someone who's well adorned. They've adorned themselves, dressed themselves, done their hair nicely, ornaments they're wearing nice clothes. And then the example of a dangerous thing to do is to get a dead snake and wrap it around your shoulders. Putrid dead snake, you know. You know, it's just like not a nice thing to do. And so are the thoughts that you're having, are they thoughts that you would like to have? Would you, someone who really you really respect a lot, would you want them to know you're thinking this? Maybe that contrast. You know, is this really what you feel good about? Do you feel good about having these thoughts? Is this something you would feel good about if someone saw? This is not to increase your self-blame. The purpose of this is to kind of loosen up the preoccupation with these kinds of thoughts. So, oh no, this, I don't think I want to be involved with this. It's painful, it's negative consequences, it's dangerous. And I didn't realize how dangerous it is. And building up a habit of having these kinds of thoughts over and over again is not useful. So the assumption here is that if you can do that, then maybe that would kind of loosen up the grip you have on your thoughts, on this holding the striker, whatever you're doing. Then this compassionate text goes on and says, well, if that doesn't work, then we have something else for you. The next thing it says, in that case, try to ignore them. Just try to kind of, I guess it's a little bit like thinking about something else, but here it says just ignore them. Don't give them any attention. So when I did wrote my dissertation, probably like, I guess, most people who write a dissertation, there are regularly thoughts, this is too difficult, I can't do this, it's too much. You know, what have I gotten myself into? It's, and I had these thoughts, and lots of them, frequently. This is impossible, I can't do it. I would spend, you know, I don't know, hours composing a footnote. You know, and the dissertation is supposed to be like a book, right? So, you know, so if that takes that long to do the footnote. And the way I treated those thoughts, I treated them like pesky flies in the background. I didn't stop them, but I ignored them. I just didn't give them any attention. I let them be in the background. And they didn't get in the way, so I just kind of kept working on the next footnote, you know, on the next sentence. And it was actually, often that was the way I was working. Let me just get through the next sentence. Because the whole dissertation was too big of a project. And so leaving these things in the background, ignoring them, if you can be very wise. This idea of ignoring them, I also relate to doing concentration practice. So, you know, this I think a lot of these directions are very useful for meditation. Meditation is a very useful place to recondition the mind, to refurbish the mind, to upgrade the mind, to change the conditioning of the mind, so that when you come out of meditation, you have a different kind of mind to work with. And so in meditation, to have an object of focus like the breath, or have loving kindness as an option, focus of the practice, and you kind of hold the course, and you don't let the mind veer off into the thoughts that it might want to have, and just hold the course. And learning how to develop a concentrated mind, do concentration practice in an effective way that is stilling, deepening, relaxing, is one of the great functions of meditation practice. And so to learn to just stay there, ignore the thoughts, don't get involved in them, and hold the course so there can be a stilling of the mind. If that doesn't work, if ignoring them doesn't work, then the text suggests that you turn your attention to something that's called the thought formations. And the thought formations I understand to be not the content of the thoughts, not the thoughts themselves, but directly into the activity, your inner process of having those thoughts. What is that inner activity like for you to be thinking? So if there's a lot of intensity around the thinking that you're having, you can feel the energetics of that intensity. If you're tense around your thoughts, you can feel the tension. if you're thinking very fast, you can feel or see the speeds of the thoughts. If there's a lot of emotions connected to the thoughts, you can feel the emotionality that's connected to the thoughts we're having. So rather than focusing on the content, we're focusing on the process of thinking itself. And then it says, then relax those. Relax the thought formations. Relax the activity that's associated with thinking. One thing that I do is I will focus on what I call the thinking muscle. And my thinking muscle for me is often in the middle of my skull, and I feel it as a kind of pressure and tension that I associate with being very involved in thinking. And I'll bring my attention to that place in my skull, feel the tension and the pressure that's connected to thinking, and then as I exhale, I'll relax it as if I'm relaxing a muscle. And sometimes I'll kind of visualize that whatever that knot is or pressure, that it flattens out. Like you have a ball of dough, and you take the roller, and it's not like you're having a roller, but it's kind of like it kind of flattens out like you're rolling out a, you know, pizza dough. It gets all kind of broad and flat. And somehow that kind of sense of it broadening out and flattening out is part of the feeling where it supports me, the stilling and the quieting of the mind. An image of this broad, quiet, still, flat surface that is used in meditation sometimes is the image of a lake, a still, quiet, pure lake. The surface completely quiet and still. So the mind kind of, the waves quiet down and the surface becomes calm and still. For people who don't have any access to the what it feels like to be involved in the thinking activity, an indirect way of getting there is, again, not focusing on the thoughts, but relaxing the body. Just seeing where is tension in the body and trying to just let the body relax and relax. Because chances are that some of the physical tension we hold in our body is connected to how we're thinking. Chances are, I think, that most of it is. And the analogy for this stilling and quieting the mind, so there's less active thinking going on, is the analogy is given is that if a person is walking fast to relax, walk slower. If the person's walking slow but wants to relax, stand still. If the person's standing still, the way to relax is sit down. And if you're sitting down, the way to relax is to lie down. So the same thing with the mind, you kind of step it down. You do less and less activity in the mind. You stop thinking about the future, stop thinking about the past. Stop judging what's happening in the present. Letting be less and less involved with thinking what's going on. And as some of you know, with the development of mindfulness, there can become a point, a shift, which is quite a remarkable shift for some people, where the mind is no longer fixated or involved in the world of thinking, but has shifted to be involved in the world of feeling and sensing. And the deeper wellsprings of joy, of happiness, of well-being, of meditation, belongs more to the world of sensing and feeling than it does to the world of thinking. And in fact, if you think too much, it gets in the way of dipping deep down into the kind of the wonderful wellsprings or pools that can happen within us. So this quieting our mental thinking, no longer being involved in it, is very helpful. And then the text. So now the text offers like four different strategies. I think they're all good strategies. But they don't work. None of it work. And you've recognized that what you're thinking about is unskillful, unhelpful, and maybe really dangerous for you. Maybe you're thinking about, all you could think about is how you're going to punch that guy out. Just get close to that guy, you know, you're just working yourself up in a lather of anger. Or you can't stop thinking about how there's a liquor store just a block away from your house, and you know you've been in recovery for 32 years, and you know it's a big deal. Your 32th anniversary is coming up, and you know it's a big deal to give it up, right? And you feel the drive and the intensity of wanting to go get some alcohol, and you can't stop thinking of it, you know. And if you lower your guard, probably you'll find yourself at the store. And so you've done all these things, and none of it works. So what do you do then in that kind of circumstance? So this is the kind of the setup here is that when nothing else works, and it's going to be really dangerous for you, what do you do? Then the text says, you clench your teeth and press your tongue up against your mouth, just like a strong man would grab a weak man and hold a person down. So it's not a very spiritually uplifting image. we prefer our spirituality to be about freedom and inspiration and non-limitation. But realistically, occasionally, this is what the mind needs. The mind has no, it says, people say the mind has no shame and will, you know, do all kinds of things, even if you think better. What the mind thinks and what the mind does sometimes, what you think and what the mind does sometimes can be different. And so sometimes, for some people, something really strong medicine is needed. And I've sat in meditation and had overwhelming urges, physical urges, to do something. Knew it wasn't appropriate to do. And it was like sitting in the rodeo, you know, on a horse, a wild horse. They just sit still. I mean, from the outside, it looked like, oh, Gil's sitting pretty still. But, you know, it was a lot of work. Just, you know, it kind of, I wasn't clenching my teeth. But it's, you know, something equivalent. So sometimes to protect ourselves from problems, this really strong medicine is needed. So the text gives these five approaches. So to replace unskillful thoughts with skillful thoughts, to give time and consideration to the dangers and downsides of what you're thinking about and how you're thinking, to ignore it, and then if none of those work, and this I think is one of the most important things for mindfulness practitioners to do, and that is to turn your attention directly to it and look it right in the face, the thinking, the activity of thinking. And then in particular, look not at the thoughts themselves, the content. You did that when you looked at the danger. But if you, rather than looking at the content of the thoughts, do this very radical and remarkable thing, which is to step out of the field or orbit of the content of what you're thinking about to look at the process of thinking, the activity of thinking. The analogy I like to give is kind of like listening to two people speak a foreign language you don't know. You have no idea what they're saying, but perhaps you can pick up a little bit about, you know, the emotional tenor of the conversation. And so you know, well, this is an intense, they're really in it, fighting it out, you know, duking it out, and because they're, it just seems like it's really heated, the conversation. You can kind of see that if you don't know the words. Or they're really, boy, those people are really relaxed and pleasant, easygoing conversation, and even though you don't know the words. So you can do the same thing with yourself. You can step back as if you don't know the language that you're thinking in. What's that inner activity like, the process like? And by doing that, it might be possible to notice what can relax. You know, you can relax, some physically relax or mentally relax, quiet what's going on. And then when you're really going to be in danger, then you're about to say something. Sometimes still I find myself wanting to say things that I shouldn't be saying. I think it's mostly around my kids. You know, giving advice when advice is not, you know, it's obvious what you should do. Let me just tell you. And so sometimes I can feel the urge to say something. And I don't clench my teeth exactly, but it's kind of like a holding back and holding in that goes on. So all this points to the possibility of taking some responsibility for our thinking, to track what goes on and not allow our thinking to have free rein to think whatever it wants, to not identify so strongly with our thinking, to not assume that who we are is in our thinking, not assume that our thinking is accurate, and not assume that our thinking is necessary, to not assume that our thinking has authority, but to begin questioning the whole process of thinking and to learn to step out of the currents, the stream of no, I can't say it anymore. Rumination. Stream of rumination. And the stream of being caught up and thinking about the same thing over and over and over again. Remember, if you keep chewing it over and over again, the raisin gets like cardboard. It's not useful to keep thinking over and over and over again. So those are my thoughts for today. And I hope that this helps you have a more peaceful mind.